From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A national strike in Venezuela, genocide in Rwanda, riots in Southeast Asia. Across the globe, power and wealth often reside in the hands of a fortunate few, what our guest tonight calls a market-dominant minority. So far, says Amy Chua, the global spread of free markets has aggravated inequity, and democracy has been like gas on the fire. Tonight on Point, the unforeseen consequences of globalization and a warning that the West is flying blind. We begin with the latest on Iraq. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said today weapons inspectors should be given more time to work before any move to war. President Bush said he's sick and tired of what he called Saddam Hussein's games and deception. And it's been reported Senate Republican leaders have caucused to debate the wisdom of war plans for Iraq. Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor for Newsweek magazine and a longtime Capitol Hill watcher. I asked if President Bush has the support he needs to go to war.
I think President Bush's approval ratings are still high enough that he can commandeer the support if he has to. But the anxiety about whether he is following the correct course is at a high level, not only among Democrats, which is predictable, but among his own Republicans, who don't really think the administration has a coherent course here. The contradiction between how they're approaching Korea, North Korea, and Iraq is difficult to get across to the voters. Mm-hmm. And I think there is also personal animosity against the Defense Secretary Rumsfeld for this high-handed way he treats members of Congress. And they all think they're terribly important, and they don't like the fact that the administration doesn't seem to treat them that way.
We've read something about that, a Republican caucus meeting last week where senators were up in arms over Rumsfeld's treatment, and it seemed almost to extend to a critique of the march to war with Iraq itself.
Right. That article was written by Bob Novak, a conservative columnist who has very good sources throughout the administration. And he reported on a closed-door meeting where prominent senators expressed irritation at the way they were being left out of the war planning, and also concern that the administration, now that they have signed on to the United Nations bureaucracy, where is the timetable for war? Everybody had been led to believe that there was only this window, late January, early February, where the weather was right and so forth. And now you have the weapons inspectors saying it'll take them at least through March to have any initial understanding, and to do their job right, it's going to take another year. And so you really have a debate within the White House and certainly on Capitol Hill as to whether war is imminent or whether it should be imminent.
Are the senators suggesting that the White House needs to push ahead to disregard the UN process, or they're simply nervous about the hovering position we're in now?
They're all reading the polls, and every poll says that the American voters do not want to proceed with an invasion of Iraq alone, that they want the company of the allies. And so I think that, except for a handful of real hardliners within the administration and sort of a chorus of outside hardliners, most people here would rather stay in the status quo stage rather than risk an invasion where the U.S. has to go virtually alone.
Meanwhile, however, the troop levels mount around Iraq. Just a couple of weeks ago, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska came back from a week-long fact-finding trip in the Middle East. And he said shortly after his return in a speech in Chicago that military force alone will neither assure a democratic transition in Iraq, bring peace to Israelis and Palestinians, nor assure stability in the Middle East. That sounds like an attack on Bush administration policy here.
Well, I think what Senator Hagel is saying, what everybody knows but doesn't want to say out loud, that the military part of handling Iraq may be the easy part. The hard part is what comes afterward, and an occupation of a country that is really made up of three warring factions would take at least a decade and would cost a lot of money. And I think Senator Hagel is being upfront when he says that. I had one member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee say to me last week, keep your eye on those troop levels. When they hit 200,000 that's when the administration can pull the trigger. They won't be there until certainly for another month, but that is apparently the magic number, and that's when Bush will really have to decide whether he goes ahead or he just keeps those troops there, which is a costly venture in and of itself.
Very hard to sustain. Hans Blix hasn't made the president's job any easier. His findings, at least if the president's job is going to war, Blix is saying that the findings in Iraq are ambiguous. I guess elsewhere at the UN, Kofi Annan said today or was urging patience, urging weapons inspectors to be given time to work before talking of war. It doesn't sound like a UN gangplank being laid out for the U.S. to walk on here.
Not at all. And, you know, in some ways, I think the president does have another year here to let this unfold. And But I think there's one thing that Republican campaign types are very certain of, that President Bush can't run for re-election with Saddam Hussein still in place. I think they're hoping that with this troop buildup that Mr. Hussein will decide that he'll take some sort of an exile package or perhaps that it would prompt some sort of a coup. I think that's probably the only way out for the administration.
And if he doesn't, do you get the feeling that the Bush administration thinks it can just bowl this war through? The president said in the last 24 hours that he's sick and tired of games and deception with Saddam Hussein. Details be damned, it sounds like he's still making the emotional case and the big frame case for war if necessary.
Yeah. I've said for a long time that you need a psychiatrist to figure out the real reasons for war here. I mean, I think there is a personal involvement that this president brings, and not only this president, but Vice President Cheney, you know, a sense that they didn't finish the job 11 years ago, and that's what they need to do, even if it doesn't totally make sense to anybody outside of a small circle of people.
Eleanor Clift, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. She spoke with me earlier from Washington. Free markets and democracy go hand in hand, or so the West assumes. Yet the reality in many countries is far from the equitable free market ideal. Proponents of globalization believe that open markets and democracy will breed peace and plenty. The truth, writes Yale law professor Amy Chua in her new book, World on Fire, is that those ideals often lead old tensions to explode. In Indonesia, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and beyond, what Chua calls a market-dominant minority controls the bulk of the wealth. Globalization, she says, heightens inequities and triggers violence. We're looking tonight at the unforeseen consequences of globalization. Can the developing world absorb free markets and democracy without exploding? Do you buy Amy Chua's view that globalization can fuel genocide? And if it does, what do we do? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Amy Chua, professor of law at Yale University and the author of World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability. Good evening and welcome, Amy Chua.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You've written a very provocative book and one that comes at a critique of globalization in an unorthodox and I think largely from a largely unexplored angle. What's the case you're making here, Amy Chua? What is it about the combination of free markets and democracy that you find so flammable when it hits many of the developing world environments that you describe?
Well, the book is actually about market-dominant minorities, and by this I mean ethnic minorities who, for widely varying reasons, will tend to dominate economically the poor indigenous majorities around them. And I suggest that market-dominant minorities, it's sort of a taboo topic, so nobody wants to talk about it, but they can be found in every corner of the world. And examples include the Chinese throughout Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. Indians in East Africa, Lebanese in West Africa, Croats in the former Yugoslavia, whites in South Africa, and so on. And the thesis is that most people tend to assume that markets and democracy naturally go together for very good reasons if you look at our own country. But in countries with a market-dominant minority, markets and democracy are actually on a collision course because markets and democracy basically benefit different ethnic groups, creating an extremely unstable and explosive situation. So take Indonesia. Well, sorry. I was just going to give you a quick example.
Please,
I think Indonesia is very stark. Free market policies in the 1980s and 1990s led to a situation in which the country's tiny 3% Chinese minority controlled an astounding 70% of the private economy. And this produced tremendous resentment, even though all boats really were lifted. I mean, I think, you know, average incomes did rise. The introduction of democracy in 1998, which was hailed with euphoria in the United States, unfortunately produced a violent backlash against both the Chinese and against markets. 5,000 shops and homes of ethnic Chinese were burned and looted. 2,000 people died. 150 Chinese women were raped. And because of threats of confiscation and nationalization, the wealthiest Chinese left the country, taking with them some between $40 and $100 billion of ethnic Chinese-controlled capital. And that's actually what has plunged Indonesia into an economic crisis from which still has not recovered. So in countries with a market-dominant minority, markets and democracy favor not just different people or different classes, but different ethnic groups. Markets make the resented minority richer and richer, while democracy empowers the poor, frustrated majority. And the result is invariably some kind of backlash.
A kind of head-on collision is set up, and you describe it vividly. Your own family story passes through this terrain in the Philippines, where, as in Indonesia, ethnic Chinese are very dominant in the local economy. This brought tragedy to your family that I think illustrates the kind of tensions you're talking about. I know it's a tough story, but describe for us the story of your Aunt Leona.
My family in the Philippines are part of the country's tiny but extremely entrepreneurial, market-dominant Chinese minority. Mm-hmm. They represent only about 1% of the country's population. This is a country of 80 million people, mm-hmm. and they're just 1% of the population, but they control as much as 60% of the private economy.
Another mind-boggling ratio, like Indonesia.
That's exactly right. And my aunt was part of that community, and her chauffeur was part of one of the, you know, 80 million extremely poor ethnic indigenous Filipinos. Mm-hmm. And in 1994, I received a call from my mother telling me that she had been killed by her chauffeur in the Philippines. And it was a family tragedy, but it was also very striking for me because the two maids confessed to taking part in the killing, but they were released and the killer was never found. In fact, there was nothing much was done about him. And
you note that the police found the motive in the police blotter was simply listed as revenge. You describe as a child walking downstairs in the night in your aunt's very large house, going one floor too far down to where the Filipinos were sleeping on a dirt floor in a sweaty, urine-smelling room beneath a mansion. The tensions are baked in the cake. They're built in here.
That's right. That recollection came back to me as I was just, you know, thinking about this. The police report did just have pretty much one word for motive, which was striking because, you know, jewels were taken, mm-hmm. money was taken, but the motive wasn't that they put down was not robbery. Or assault. It was just revenge. And it's very standard in the Philippines for the policemen to just turn a blind eye. They're very sympathetic. They don't necessarily endorse the killings, but they're very sympathetic to the kidnappings.
As ethnic Filipinos, by and large.
Right. All the policemen essentially are ethnic Filipinos. And in some ways, they view it as a form of redistribution. They're often quoted as saying, well, if the Chinese can afford the ransom.
So you're saying, Amy Chua, at the largest level, and we're heading into a break here, but you're saying when we step on the globalization accelerator, we actually trigger a kind of a head-on conflict in many of these countries.
Right. Well, there's often a misunderstanding. I'm actually very much in favor of globalization. This is not an anti-globalization book. And I'm mm-hmm. also in favor of promoting both markets and democracy globally. But I think that there are many different versions of free market democracy. And I do think that we're exporting the wrong one, sort of a caricature of free market democracy. You know, for example, on the market side, there's no Western nation today with anything close to a laissez-faire system. We have progressive taxation and antitrust laws. And yet, for the last 20 years, that's what we've been, you know, urging the poorest countries of the world to adopt a raw, bare-knuckled version of capitalism.
And there it is. Amy Chua, stand by. We've got to take a break.
Okay.
We're talking tonight about the unintended consequences of the global push for free markets and democracy. Have we blindly celebrated globalization without understanding its full impact? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight is Amy Chua. She's written a new book called World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability. She's looking at the unintended consequences of the global push for free markets and democracy. Do you buy that free markets and democracy can fuel even genocide? If the rewards of globalization are not equitably shared, does it provoke more conflict than it solves? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy, the Southeast Asia picture is one that I know well. The Wachau overseas Chinese are so dominant, as you say there. Some countries in that region have taken steps for a long time now to address that. In Malaysia, there's the whole, of course, Bumiputra policy, favoring kind of sons of the soil, native Malays over generations of Chinese immigrants. Are you looking to that as a solution? Are you saying we need kind of social engineering to re-engineer these societies before the full impact of globalization hits them?
No, I don't have much confidence in the social engineering idea. I do take a look at the MLA case. It's very interesting. These are often called affirmative action programs, but that's a misnomer because this is affirmative action for the majority of the country, mm-hmm. not for a minority. So in some ways,
but is that not appropriate if, as you say, there's a market-dominating minority? Maybe the majority is the one that needs that affirmative action.
Yes, exactly. So I sort of urge people not to import their negative feelings about affirmative action in this country to countries where the demographics are totally different. The Malaysian case is interesting. It's imperfect. I mean, I'm very aware of the imperfections of that program. The affirmative action policies tended to favor elite Malays rather than very poor Malays. It did not succeed in eradicating poverty. But I do think that Malaysia's policies did help alleviate ethnic tensions in that country. And if you compare it to Indonesia, I think it does provide a model that can't just be copied wholesale, but that, you know, it does offer one possible route.
And let's unroll the map a little further here, Amy Chua. You're talking about not just Southeast Asia, but Russia, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, former Yugoslavia. Describe for us how you see this dynamic playing out in each of those settings.
Okay. One reason that this doesn't get talked about is because there's something that seems very uncomfortable about talking about ethnic generalizations. But I really don't think that this should be a taboo topic because by market dominance, I'm absolutely not talking about any kind of inherent superiority or inherent entrepreneurialism. One of the big points of my book is that groups can be market dominant for widely varying reasons, including, you know, culture, but also including apartheid or a history of colonial oppression. So if, as with the white minority in South Africa, you basically relegate the majority to inferior education and inhumane conditions for over a century, then you're going to be a market-dominant minority, and this has nothing to do with culture or anything else.
Take us through your other examples. Who's dominant where?
Well, in Zimbabwe, for example, whites are only 1% of the population, but for generations controlled 70% of the country's best land and almost all of its commercial wealth in the form of these big 3,000-acre commercial farms.
And is that largely true even now after Mugabe's confiscations?
Well, no, his confiscations were exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Mugabe, people don't like to admit this, but Mugabe, despite his terrible actions, is in many ways the product of democracy. People forget that he first came to power 30 years ago by campaigning on an anti-white, we'll take back the land policy. And he was extremely popular as Nelson Mandela. And he did not redistribute the land in part because of a pact or a pressure from Great Britain. Mm-hmm. But every time elections rolled around, he would once again start his ethnic demagoguery, start scapegoating the whites and, you know, talking about confiscating the land. So unfortunately, I think that his terrible tactics are sort of the underside of democracy. And
pushed by democracy to some extent, as unpretty as they certainly are. How about the former Yugoslavia, Venezuela, your other examples?
In the former Yugoslavia, that's a more complicated case because there were many different groups, the Croatians, the Slovenes, Albanians, many minorities who were not market dominant. But among many other complicated dynamics, one was the fact that the northern regions were much more prosperous and kind of linked to Western Europe and Germany and Austria, starkly more prosperous and developed than the much more populous southern areas. And I do suggest in my book that among many other dynamics, the Croats were a market-dominant ethnic minority in the former Yugoslavia, and it was all sort of kept under taps under Tito. And it was a time bomb waiting to explode.
And you describe in gruesome detail how Milosevic exploited that, and the results were murder, death camps, rape camps, the whole thing. You tie it back to that economic relationship.
Right. Now, it's not. I'm not at all suggesting that it's the ethnic conflict is solely because of economic reasons. This is just one of many factors. But it's a very stark pattern that keeps happening. Milosevic came to power in democratic elections, free and fair elections, and he came to power on an explicitly ethno-nationalist, anti-Croatian platform. And he scapegoated and attacked, and people voted for him. He campaigned on a Serbia for Serbs platform. And there's a very telling quotation where he campaigned and he actually said, speaking of the Serbs, so if we don't know how to work well or do business well, at least we know how to fight, and, you know, to cheering crowds. Mm-hmm. And sadly, he was voted in,
and we know the rest
the genocides
of that story.
There, right, were actually, you know, very much mass supported in the face of just...
Mm.
I'm sorry, I was just saying, you know, long suppressed feelings of humiliation and frustration.
And you draw this dynamic even down to the Rwanda example and the terrible genocide there. But pull the globalization thread through this picture, Imichwa. You open our eyes or remind us that there are market-dominating minorities in many countries around the world. But how do you see the impact of globalization ratcheting up the tension so violently?
Okay. Well, first of all, again, just to clarify, it's a great question. I'm definitely not saying that I'm not blaming ethnic conflict on globalization. There certainly has been ethnic conflict forever. You know, it's almost part of human nature,
but you are drawing a connection.
But I am saying that the two major components of globalization, I think, are the spread of free markets and also the spread of democracy.
So the free market benefits the minority, not the mass. Is that what you're saying to begin with?
Yes. And that free markets, at least in its sort of raw, unrestrained form, tends, in countries with a market-dominant minority, it tends to disproportionately benefit the market-dominant minority. Now, again, all boats may be lifted. Everybody may be benefited. But what happens is it concentrates this visible, glaring wealth in the hands of this market-dominant minority. And then,
and you're saying that's happening at the same time that the democracy thrust is coming in, empowering the very mass that's feeling resentment about that wealth.
Exactly. And what often happens then is that democracy, instead of, you know, turning everybody into open-minded co-citizens, as we sort of expect from the West, has just the opposite effect, which is that it encourages the emergence of demagogues who don't have much to offer the country except for these hateful, hate-mongering policies. And they basically generate mass support for themselves by targeting these outsiders. And this is really different from the United States because, you know, like in the United States, there have been points where Bill Gates has controlled as much as 40% or as much as 40% of the rest of America put together. Mm. But Americans don't hate Bill Gates. They, you know, when the government went after him, they wanted, most polls showed that they wanted the government to leave him alone. And I think that's because there's a sense of upward mobility or possibility here because we don't have a market dominant minority. You know, the wealth is not concentrated in the hands of an outsider minority. So when people still see Bill Gates, even if they're very poor, they feel like, you know, maybe my son can be Bill Gates, maybe my daughter. It's not the case in countries countries are the market dominant minority.
I was just going to say, in these countries,
the rich are not just rich, but they actually belong to a different ethnic group.
They're the other. You know, this is a message we in many ways don't want to hear. It's not so long ago since New York Times columnist Tom Friedman had his book out, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, with this kind of message that free markets and democracy across the globe would turn friends and enemies into competitors, and that would be a much more peaceable kingdom. You're saying no.
I am saying no. I respect Tom Friedman a lot, and especially his views on the Middle East, but I just don't think that, you know, that anything in the last 20 years suggests that's true. I mean, people thought after the fall of the Berlin Wall that Marxist democracy would exactly turn everybody into open-minded co-citizens and consumers, with kind of ethnic and religious hatred somehow being swept magically away. But if you look at the last 20 years, just the opposite has happened.
So in a nutshell, what do we do?
Well, I am in favor of promoting both markets and democracy globally. And I think we need to think much harder about what kinds of markets we should be promoting and what kinds of democracy. So on the market side, I think we absolutely need to find ways of giving the poor majorities of the developing world a sense of a stake in market economies. And that's where your Malaysia example was interesting, because these affirmative action policies that would turn most American stomachs, I mean, these are ethnic quotas. You know, they'd say, we can privatize this company, but 30% of these shares must go to ethnic Malays.
Without apology.
Without apology, or Chinese companies would be restructured. Suddenly you have a Malay partner that you can't choose. And so it's terrible in one sense. But on the other hand, it forces people to work together, and it's a way of redistributing. But it's also a way of giving the indigenous Malay majority a sense of having a stake in these corporations, a stake in the markets. You know, in the United States, even our lower or middle classes have pension funds. They own stocks, and they're interested in how the New York Stock Exchange performs. And that's just not the case in so many developing countries where, you know, the poor majorities just, they hear about privatization, and for them it just means, you know, prices go up and unemployment. And so I think we need to find ways of giving the poor majorities, ways of spreading the benefits of global markets. On the democracy side, I think it's much more difficult. I do think that we've been promoting a caricature of democracy. Since 1989, the U.S. government has just been pressing developing countries everywhere to hold immediate elections and implement immediate universal suffrage. And putting aside the point that we did not pursue that track of democratization, I mean, all the Western nations
It took us a while.
It took us a long time. We had property exclusions. We had lots of disenfranchisement. But I think that's out of the question. But I do think that in the West, democracy means much more than just elections and unrestrained majority rule.
You describe it as meaning kind of mutual obligations within the society that may not exist or be codified in some of these markets.
Right. I think that I think it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Mm-hmm. I think democracy is each country has to figure out what it is for itself. But it's also about, at a minimum, minority protections, property protections, constitutionalism, human rights. Basically, a lot more is needed than just shipping out ballot boxes for elections, which brought people like Slobodan Milosevic to power.
Amy Chua, hold the thought. We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Okay. I want to invite them in. Len's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Len. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Chua, I think your thesis is a very interesting one, and it certainly seems to ring true for Southeast Asia. However, I think you're very off base in trying to apply this to Venezuela. I don't think we've gotten a chance to talk about that yet tonight, but I've heard your comments on that in other media. In Indonesia, a Javanese person can become very wealthy but will still be Javanese. They won't change into being Chinese. In Venezuela, a Venezuelan of African descent who becomes very wealthy, things are a little more complicated.
A more permeable membrane there.
Yeah, and I think the mistake that Professor Cho is making here is a common one from American observers of Latin America in trying to ascribe American racial paradigms to Latin America and Venezuela in particular. I think these groups in Venezuela we would look at these groups and say, oh, this is an ethnically divided society. They don't see themselves that way. Now, that's certainly not to say that race and racism don't exist or aren't important, but and certainly race is highly correlated with class, but I think what's driving the conflict, certainly around the disagreements in Venezuelan society about Chavez, what the driving force behind that is not race, it's social
right.
class.
And yet, Len, you can hear in the debate swirling around Hugo Chavez and in his own language a kind of holding up of ethnic divisions to some extent, a kind of celebration on his part of indigenous peoples, people closer to indigenous bloodlines.
Let me just say that I actually agree with everything you said. You probably haven't read my book yet. I actually try not to import the North American lens. Mm-hmm. I talk a lot about the mesticized ethnic structures there and the pigmentocracy. That is the core of the overlap between class and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. It's a very common feeling in most Latin American societies to say that we don't have ethnic conflict here because everybody's mixed-blooded. And you are right that the Spanish colonizers from the very outset procreated extensively with the indigenous and even African population. So it is a very different structure. So I really want to agree with you. I think that my point about Venezuela is maybe being misunderstood because I don't disagree with you. Let me just try to state it. I think that ethnic divisions are much more muted in Latin America, and that it's certainly the current conflict is not about race, or I would never suggest that. But my point is that I think that the current crisis is in some ways the product of the clash between free markets and democratic politics. So free market policies historically tended to disproportionately favor a minority of cosmopolitan, lighter-skinned elites. And you're absolutely right. That's a much more permeable class. It's not a stark thing. But my point about Chavez is that he is a bit analogous to a Milosevic or a Mugabe in that he didn't have much to offer the country, I don't think. So he generated mass support for himself by deliberately fomenting class conflict and by lacing it with ethnic resentment. So while there wasn't really much ethnic conflict before, he tried to play the ethnic card. He called himself the Indian from Barinas. He scapegoated the white elite, calling them oligarchs, rotten oligarchs, and championing the rights of the sort of excluded masses. So I don't think that we disagree. And, I hope that in my book...
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound like we do.
Yeah. And I'm just saying that he... that I'm really highlighting his ethnic demagoguery as one of the dangers of democracy in societies with extreme wealth disparities, low levels of education, and I guess enough ethnic distinctions that they can be manipulated.
Len, I see here that you're an economist. What do you think of Amy Chua's overall analysis here? Do we need to step off the gas pedal on globalization until we figure out this ethnic element?
No, I think I'm in agreement with her that democracies are and markets are the right way to go. I think she's raising very valid concerns about what some of the unintended consequences could be when you have economic activity concentrated in a minority. And I'm happy to hear that her views on Latin American ethnicity is more nuanced than the sound bites that I've heard had made that out to be.
Great. Len, thanks so much for your call. Amy,
Thank
when
you.
We come back, we want to talk about Americans as a market-dominating minority.
Okay.
But just for starters, you're saying we may have this problem writ large as Americans globally. We may be seen as the one to envy and to strike out at.
Right. I make an argument that sort of at the global level, we've become the world's market-dominant minority. Just 4% of the world's population, and yet we control such a wildly disproportionate amount of the world's economic and political power that you see some of the same kinds of resentments, envies, and dynamics.
We'll come back and talk about that. We're looking at the unintended consequences of the global push for free markets and democracy. Was Tom Friedman too optimistic in the Lexus and the olive tree? Does globalization not solve but pour gasoline on local conflicts? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unintended consequences of the global push for free markets and democracy. My guest tonight is Amy Chua. She's a professor at Yale Law School and author of World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability. The question for you, is the combination of free markets and democracy a recipe for conflict in ethnically, economically divided societies? And will the primary beneficiaries of globalization, including Americans, have to surrender a portion of their benefits to get buy-in from the rest of the world? Are we flying blind in the rush to globalize. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy, just before the break, we took it up to the next level. That is, Americans as globally a market-dominant minority. This is different from a minority within a country, but you say not altogether different, and you draw a line between that status of a small percentage of Americans dominating so much of the world's wealth and terror.
That's right. This is an argument just made by analogy, because, of course, Americans are not an ethnic minority. We're a national origin minority, which is a close cousin, and nor is there, you know, democracy at the global level. But you're exactly right. I think after September 11th, Americans all over the country kept, you know, amidst many other emotions, kept returning to the question, why do they hate us so much? And my book offers one, certainly not the only answer, and that is that America has today at the global level become the equivalent of the world's market dominant minority. Just like the Chinese in Indonesia or the Lebanese in West Africa, Americans as a nation have attained heights of wealth and economic power wildly disproportionate to our tiny numbers. Again, we're just 4% of the world's population, but we're perceived everywhere as the engine and principal beneficiary of international capitalism. And for this, we have earned the fear, envy, and resentment of much of the rest of the world. Now, of course, not everybody who envies and resents us wants to kill us, but there are, I think, those who do. And I think that the 9/11 attack on America was an act of revenge directly analogous to the bloody confiscations of white land in Zimbabwe or the anti-Chinese looting in Indonesia, fueled by the same feelings of envy and grievance, powerlessness, and humiliation. Now, I'm not saying that these are the only reasons.
It's a big statement. And, of course, these were Saudis, you know, from a country with no small wealth itself. But if we take what you say at face value, it's such a challenge to the direction that the global locomotive has been going in here. I mean, the idea seemed to be throw out the seeds of free market and democracy and let them grow. You seem to be describing a kind of vast global social engineering project required to have that growth take place. They seem at odds.
Well, I wouldn't say global social engineering. Believe it or not, I'm actually an optimist. People often, you know, take my ideas and feel like they're depressing. But I feel that we have not, as a nation, not put much thought into what we're telling everybody to adopt all over the world. So, you know, we're basically exporting this kind of laissez-faire capitalism that the U.S. and Europe gave up a long time ago. It's a real anachronism. And same with democracy. I mean, just calling for elections. So I wouldn't call it social engineering, but kind of asking ourselves, you know, what do we mean when we say we want Venezuela to have a democracy? Is it, you know, in this kind of case, they voted in a person who has distinctly anti-democratic leanings, who's anti-market, who calls Cuba a sea of happiness. And so, you know,
so are you saying back off of democracy? This sounds kind of like the gang in Beijing saying, maybe someday, but don't bother us. We order comes first.
Now, that is a position people hold. Robert Kaplan is a well-respected political commentator who has actually advocated markets first, democracy later. You know, let markets create a middle class first, and then we can democratize. And that's actually not my own position. I've struggled with that, and it's not my own position because how are you going – the real problem for me is you cannot – assure that you're going to get a beneficent dictator. I mean, you might ask for a Lee Kuan Yew, which a lot of people do. People say, look at Singapore or look at China. But if you ask for Lee Kuan Yew, what's going to prevent you from getting an Idi Amin instead?
And what if Lee Kuan Yew is not what your heart desires?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. That's a whole other issue.
Singapore's pretty laced up pretty tight for some people's tastes.
That's right, and pretty sterile place. Wouldn't be my choice anyway. But just giving it the benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
That's why. So I am definitely in favor of figuring out. I support efforts to democratize and to sponsor democracy, but I do think that it takes more thought, and that it can't just be elections.
Amy, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Okay. Emmanuel is on the line. Hi, Emmanuel. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Nice hearing this such a program going on, and I pretty much support what the professor is saying. I've been a citizen from a country that have gone through tremendous political unrest and all kinds of violence.
Which country is that?
Liberia.
Uh-huh,
Liberia.
All right.
It is principally due to the fact that the West never encouraged a market economy or even to say political economy, especially in the area of agriculture, education, and science. They did not do anything at all. They only forced the governments, to come up with a system of democracy. But then economically, they did not support. And this brought in the Lebanese, who came in and, for the past almost 60 or 70 years have exploited the economy in a way that we have no kinds of program that we can say is in some form of industrialization.
So, Emmanuel, as an ethnic Liberian, you see an example of a market-dominant minority, the Lebanese in Liberia's case, dominating the local economy. And when the World Bank says, turn more toward the free market, do you agree with Amy Chua that this benefits that Lebanese minority and not the general population?
Exactly. And it's getting to be it's a serious thing because we are losing the rainforest. And Liberia is one of the countries with the largest rainforest in the world. And the world is sitting down with losing it because of this particular problem.
Have you had violence, ethnic violence, toward the Lebanese or not?
No, we have never had ethnic violence towards the Lebanese. We've never had. But The problem is because we do not have the support of the West in the era of transfer of technology in, let's say, the rubber industry and the mining industry. Mm-hmm. For over half a century, they exploited this industry. They did not do anything to encourage a market economy or some form of industrialization, which is right. And it is breeding a lot of the violence we see in West Africa now.
Emmanuel, it sounds like you're confirming a case in point here. Thank you for your call. Amy, describe how it works. Let's say there's a market-dominant minority, whether it's the Lebanese in West Africa or the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. Now there's a push toward globalization. How exactly do the mechanics work that it only benefits that dominant minority?
Well, it's not that it only
or not
benefits
only,
that
but overwhelmingly,
dominant minority,
as you
but
say.
It disproportionate. Often it's because of a massive head start. These groups often, even though they owe their market dominance to different reasons, will often have tremendous advantages in education or capital. I mean, mm-hmm. The Chinese minorities of Southeast Asia are starting with so much more capital than the poor indigenous majorities around them.
So if an outside investor comes in, he or she is naturally going to want to link up with people who have the expertise, the education, the capital.
Absolutely. Foreign investors, their natural partners will be these market-dominant minorities, mm-hmm. and that's absolutely true. So the dynamics are that markets create the kind of disproportionate concentration of wealth in the hands of the small outsider minority. And just as the person was describing, this creates a tremendous feelings of resentment mm-hmm. and outrage among the indigenous majorities that, don't feel that they're benefiting from markets. Now, when democracy is added to the picture, this empowers the poor majority, and several things can happen. I actually am very specific. I say that it creates a very unstable situation, mm-hmm. this collision between markets and democracy in the face of a market-dominant minority, and that you can get three kinds of backlash.
All right.
One is you can get a backlash against markets that targets the market-dominant minority's wealth.
All right, the Lebanese, the Chinese, whoever.
Mm-hmm. Right, so people will vote in policies, as in Indonesia. They mm-hmm. basically, the government has essentially nationalized $58 billion of Chinese assets right now. And this happened to the Lebanese in West Africa, too, that, bouts of democracy would bring in these anti-market policies where they would put restrictions on the Lebanese.
And the second option?
The second option, in the contest between a rich minority and a poor majority, sometimes the minority wins. So a second option is a backlash against democracy that favors the market-dominant minority. And this is basically crony capitalism. Mm-hmm. So many times – in fact, I suggest that the world's most notorious cases of crony capitalism all involved a market-dominant minority. Kenya, a case we haven't talked about. Mm-hmm. President Moi did an about-face a while ago, when he decided to go into cahoots with the country's extremely market-dominant
Indians, right?
Yes. They're called Asians there, but Indian minority. And the arrangement is that, they would be allowed to make lots of money as long as they kicked back certain benefits to
Moi. So it works for the elite of the majority, but not the general population.
Yes, and often not even just the elite, often just a few people. Mm-hmm. In Marcos's mm-hmm. case in the Philippines, it was really a small handful.
Right.
And to be fair, I want to make clear that it's not that all members of the market dominant minority engage in this kind of crony capitalism. Mm-hmm. The sad truth is it's usually just one or two big tycoons who have this political favoritism.
And the third option.
And then the resentment, by the way, is directed at, you know, the average member of the market dominant minority.
Unfairly, but there it is.
Exactly. And the third option is violence. It's the worst option. It's where you basically get majority supported actions to try to eliminate the market dominant minority. For example, through expulsion or even through mass killing or genocide. And I do talk about those.
We have more callers. Firas is calling from Pittsburgh. Hi, Firas. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, incidentally, I'm Lebanese, and I can identify with what you were saying about the Lebanese ethnic minority in West Africa.
Yes.
And also, we also had the same problem with the Maronite Christians in Lebanon. I don't want to call it a problem, but they were the favorite minority by the French. And
yes.
when we established a democratic constitution in Lebanon, eventually the majority voted us out of democracy. The Muslim demagogues, well, I don't want to call them Muslims, but demagogues took us back out of that. But my question relates more on a global way, and if we could find an analogy with like this. Now they're trying to impose on Muslim nations a democracy, and I don't want to impose is probably too strong a word, but in countries like Iran, where the majority of people supported taking American hostages, it was the revolution, and your students were backing the Khomeini. You can't just call that it was an oligarchy 20 years ago. It was more of a nation behind that idea and against what the Shah was standing for.
But it was 20 years ago, Firas.
Exactly. And my point is, it took 20 years to brew the kind of feelings that they have now, which is now they're voting Khatami, and you have students protesting against the conservatives. So I'm just saying that this time scale is the best time scale for a nation to acquire the values, like, and to disseminate the values of, you know, democracy.
Firas, your line is breaking up, but I think we've got the point. I want to put it to Amy Chua. Thank you for your call. Amy Chua, here, Firas is saying you can't rush the democracy part of this, but I'm scratching my head as he's talking, as you've been talking with us tonight. If you don't have that democratic lever, how do you ever push toward a more equitable distribution of wealth in these countries? Why is that minority going to give it up if there's not the cudgel of democracy there? Who else is going to push it?
Well, that's a tough question. First of all, even with democracy, many developing countries have such weak states and such sort of pervasive corruption that you don't get the redistribution anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But your you know, question's a bigger one. And one of my proposals is I actually urge voluntary generosity on the part of market-dominant minorities, whether we're talking about the Chinese minority of Indonesia or United States at a global scale.
And are you serious? It would have to be on such a vast scale, it's hard to imagine.
Well, you know, a lot of this is symbolic. I think part of the enormous resentment that is felt against market-dominant minorities is this feeling, whether maybe not justified, but the sense that this minority is making so much money, it controls so much wealth, and it's arrogant. It doesn't care about the rest of us. They're not team players. This is certainly how a lot of people view the Chinese in Southeast Asia, or some people would say this about the Jews in post-communist Russia.
So you're saying they have to stand and lay out some cash, lay out some capital for the others.
I think just contributions that, you know, signal that, look, we are part of this nation and our interests are shared. We're not outsiders. That's a label that's stuck onto them anyway. It's very artificial. Some of these groups have been in these countries for four generations. They're not really outsiders. So I think, you know, gestures, the symbolic value may be more important than the actual redistribution.
Amy Chua, you painted a picture so big that we can only hope that a little symbolism will work. The meat of it is a large thing to take on, but we thank you for the nuance that you've brought to our understanding of this whole globalization dynamic tonight. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Amy Chua is professor of law at Yale University and author of World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from George Hicks, John Parati, and Sky Rode. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're